I was lucky enough to spend an hour with philosopher, writer and man clown Stuart Lee, where we discussed, amongst other things, milestone birthdays.
Well, I thought 40 was pretty good fun. I thought it was really funny, but 50 I've found that pretty depressing.
This is where I'm at.
Not for about a year. It was all right at first. I thought it was funny to say, well, I'm 50 and what I think is actually...
All right, Grandad.
Well, 51's pretty nuts.
Good one, wasn't it?
51's sort of... Because you can sort of mark out the rest of your...
Have you ever gone in as a 50-year-old, I think, this?
Yeah. But I wouldn't... But it's not as funny as being... It just feels a bit...
I wonder if being... What is 50 like for being... When you're a bloke? Because for me, about to turn 50, it feels like I don't want to be part... Into the era of invisibility. That's what they call 50 years.
Well, I got mugged, actually, in November.
A nice celebratory mugging.
Is this on there?
Yes!
Yeah, yeah. I got mugged in November, and it was a real eye-opener, actually, because what happened was... it was November the 5th, or that weekend, and I was walking along with the kids about 4:30 by the park, and they'd gone on a little bit ahead of me, luckily, and I had two shopping bags full of baked beans and bread, and from Happy Shoppers, like really ordinary things, and I was in a long coat with a big... I grew a big beard, really massive beard, after the last thing I did on telly, because there were a lot of jokes about Brexit, and I was worried about being murdered in the street, so I sort of went into disguise, basically. And anyway, there's a gang of about 10, 15 kids running along, and the blocking the pavement, and one of them stood in front of me and did that sort of like a gangster gun turn sort of hand gesture at me with a lighted firework, right? And I think that if you do stand up, and probably lots of other things, but I only know it from stand up, I think that your fight and flight mechanism is suppressed, right? And so from being heckled or dealing with stuff on stage. And you realise there's an evolutionary reason for the fight or flight mechanism, which is not to
protection.
Be harmed by things. So he was standing there pointing this rocket at me.
Yeah.
And I went, what are you serious? You're going to shoot a rocket at me? And he went, and then he let it go, and it just sort of went over me or past me or something. And then I was still in, like, crowd control mode. I hadn't...
so you still on put down?
I was going, the fuck, you know, what are you doing, you idiot? You know, you can't do that. It's not worth it, is it? You'll end up in prison for shooting a firework at me. It's pathetic. You fucking idiot, you know. And I just hadn't sort of thought it through. And then he sort of comes up and starts pushing me around. They're only about 14, most of them. Then some others go, like, round the back of me. And then some more come in front of me, and one's like going like he's going to get a knife out. Another bloke rabbit punches me in the back of the head, which I read afterwards is pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
So and then I dropped all my shopping, it all fell on the floor. But even as it was happening, I was sort of thinking, oh, if I can sort of survive this, it's sort of become material, won't it? You know. And then when it looked like they were going for a knife, a sort of woman about 40 who'd been watching in the front garden. She sort of stepped in, and I think that kind of embarrassed everyone into calming down a bit. But even as they started going off, I was still shouting at them, it's ridiculous, what on earth? Why would you do that? Well, wait. And then they sent the littlest one back, who was probably about 11. Having rabbit punched me in the head, shot a firework at me, and looked, they were going to stab me. They sent the littlest one back to help me put my shopping back in the bags. Yeah, but it was interesting because obviously, for the first time, I realised I had absolutely no power. And when you talk about invisibility, you're talking about, I think women of a certain age suddenly notice a sort of sexual invisibility.
Yeah.
They're not being harassed as much as they were, or approached, or whatever.
Yeah.
And like with me, I thought, oh, yeah, there's no reason for teenage boys to be... I look like a little old fat man with a beard doing his shopping, and I've got no... And I'm actually rather.
So it's a loss of potency for you. You don't look like someone that can take on an 11-year-old.
Yeah, I know, but exactly. But I realised that I've quite a lot in my life. I've enjoyed shouting at people and shock. You know, if people are dropping litter or whatever, I'd go, "Don't do that," and then they'll go, "Oh," and like, you know, I've sort of done that a lot. But also, it's not just being a little old man, and it's like having kids as well. You think, God, it's really not worth being killed over a status issue about having a firework shot near you rather than directly at you, you know. But it was weird, and the kids were just a bit up the road. They'd gone ahead on their bikes, and they were 7 and 11, and they came back and they went, "Are you all right?" And a woman had said them the bad men were beating up their dad or something, and they obviously it's embarrassing to be sort of beaten up in front of your for your children. Then, and then at night, I'd arrange to take them and their friends to the fireworks in the park. Then I was suddenly slightly worried about going to the fireworks because I thought, well, what if they're there and I'm the bloke that had this, like, standoff with them, you
know? It's easier to cover up a targeted firework attack in the middle of a bonfire celebration. Yeah.
So I had to get one. I got one of the kids has got two mums, and they came. The two mums came with me to the fireworks to protect me.
You had a from personal lesbian from the protection teenage squad. Boys.
So
that's perfect.
And it's real North London stuff. But anyone listening to this is going to go, "That's the Metropolitan Liberal League all over."
I couldn't pinpoint their socioeconomic grouping, but when Stuart said he was protected,
you know, but it was a funny. That was a funny thing of like. Yeah, I thought I'm in my 50s now. I'm a sort of ineffectual figure that's shoved around and drops his beans in the street. That sounds like a euphemism for something, doesn't it?
I've dropped my beans.
Drop my beans.
How's Stu? He's all right, but I think he might have dropped his beans. That might be where he's at right now. But then all of... I don't know. I mean, I suppose I've known you for what? 30 years.
Well, I remember seeing, I saw you on stage, first of all, I think in Edinburgh in some student gig somewhere. And it was probably about 30 years, yeah. It was really good, yeah.
We've gone, we've gone down the hill since then. But I don't think I saw you on stage first. I did obviously see you on stage a lot at that period, but I think there was probably a sort of bar in Edinburgh. We all used to coagulate there, didn't we?
Well, it's weird, isn't it, to think that was like 30 years ago. There would have been about a quarter of the amount of shows on, and there was a lot less comedy, and there wasn't all these private bars attached to big venues. So you tended to run into people in the same places. I was thinking about that when I was there this summer. Actually, I was wandering around, and my wife had her birthday. She's 3 years younger than me, so she's not had the shock of 50 yet. But she had her birthday in a bar, and I suddenly realised that the bar was a place that I'd done a student play in 1987, which was not a venue anymore, but I recognised it from the shape of the floor, which was some steps going down with sort of Doric kind of columns around it. And I thought, wow, that's so amazing. Sort of flashback to 1987. I was the waiter in Death of a Salesman there. And Sam West, who's now, you know, from Narnia, isn't he?
Yeah.
And things like that. He was someone in it. I can't remember what he was, but he was in it, I remember. Abbey Laird Hall, it was called then, but it's called... It's got a, like a one syllable name that's onomatopoeic now. You know, that's what bars and things are called now, isn't it? They used to be called after animals and flags.
Yeah, it was
and
all
things.
Zebras and tiger.
Splurf or something. I don't know. Anyway, that was in there, and I thought, God, this is really. It feels like a long time, you know.
It does. I mean, but sort of, but also yesterday in that same way that time. You know, time's just merely constructed for us to navigate our way around, isn't it? And when I think back at Edinburgh, it feels like I'm sort of still there and learning and around everybody. And then I look in the mirror and think, who is that old lady?
You look exactly the same, though, to be
but
fair.
But I just don't, though, Stuart. I think your eyesight is withering on the
phone. It is, actually.
I think it is.
I've got hearing aids, but I haven't put them in.
You and I share.
Because I can see.
You and I share a tinnitus problem. We I don't know how bad yours is, but mine is annoyingly not come from listening to loud gigs, which
nor
I suspect
mine.
Hasn't it?
I thought it would have done, and then I went to the doctors and they showed me some chart which showed there wasn't a point of acoustic trauma that could have caused it, yeah.
Do you grind your teeth? Are you a stressy person?
A bit, yeah.
Mine's from grinding my teeth. So I blame everyone around me, yeah.
Really?
It's from just... So, like, at night, when I can do nothing about it, my jaw just... applies maximum pressure. So I'll just go through all the mouth guards and that's what causes it.
Good, I didn't know that. It can happen from that.
What a stress. Yeah. What are we doing to ourselves?
I don't know. Mine's actually been a lot better since about 5 or 6 years ago. I found out I was deaf enough to need hearing aids. And actually, that seems to have changed it. I don't know. I don't really get it now unless I'm really, really annoyed about something and wound up.
So that's completely really sorted it. The fact
more or less, yeah.
So but now you're more, I suppose, attuned to the changes in temperature in your audience.
Yeah. It was unbelievable, right? Because I'll tell you why I thought something was up. I did a room in Melbourne in 2000 or 97. Maybe. Anyway, some room I did in Australia in 97 for a month. I remember it going pretty well. Then I went back there in 2005, same room. I thought, God, I must have got loads worse because this room used to sound really like it was full of laughs. And and I probably hadn't got that much worse in that time. So I thought something was going on. I just couldn't hear the room the same way. Also, I always used to feel like there were people on the far back right-hand side of the room who weren't getting it, right? And it's interesting. I thought, why do they always sit over there? And also, I started to develop this sort of act, which was very... It became more and more about being annoyed with the audience for not getting it.
That's so interesting, because you do in your act talk about pockets of... Like, you often locate it physically in a room and go, you over there.
Yeah, I know. Well, actually, then in about 2012 or something, 11, I met my real dad for the first time. It was a whole other story. But anyway, my wife had been saying, you're going deaf all the time. So I was going, no, I'm all right. And the first thing I noticed about him was that he had hearing aids in, and his salmon pink trousers. But the first thing I said to him was, oh, you've got hearing aids. And the first thing he said to me in this monumental meeting was, yes, all the men in your family go deaf, and so will you, right? So I went for a thing, and they went, NHS goes, yeah, of course you need hearing aids. Put these in. I had my daughter with me, who was about three at the time, and she was sitting on a seat in there, and soon I could sort of hear the sound of the fabric of her clothes against
them. For the first time.
Yeah, and then it's like an acid trip having it. Then I started having them putting them on stage, and I realised the gigs have been going a lot better than I thought for some time, and I developed this hostile persona based on it feeling like it was much more hard work than it was, which was weird. But again, dealing with that, so I remember the first summer I had them, and I was at the Stand in Edinburgh in the cellar there, and I thought, there's people talking. It was like builders on the other side of the road, you know. It was like being Superman or a werewolf or something.
Yeah.
You had to then learn to get stuff out, which is why I don't have them in all the time, because it'd just be too much. But it's absolutely incredible. I cannot believe how much of a room you can hear, and people mumbling and individual laughs.
But I just had no... That fascinates me that it was a physiological problem that created the personality.
To some extent, yeah. I mean, obviously you've got to be predisposed towards it. Because what I did with Brendan Burns, you must know.
Yeah.
I didn't know he was deaf. And he developed this shouting character. Which we now realise was because he couldn't hear him.
Himself, yeah.
So I used to think, why? Just calm down. You know.
But essentially, you haven't moderated the way that you speak to an audience now that your hearing is perfect.
Yeah,
it's just obviously a trope that's worked for you.
Yeah, it's worked. Yeah. Although, actually, I'm not really, in this new tour, I'm not really doing that sort of thing. I'm kind of putting that on the back burner for a bit. I'm trying to do two fun 55-minute sets.
This is Snowflake Tornado.
Yeah, back to back, because I feel everyone, you know, I feel we do have a responsibility. And I think at the moment, people just need a laugh, don't they, Sue?
You just need
cheering up.
You've always been known for your civic responsibility.
They don't want to come out at the moment and be picked on and told that they're, you know. So I do think that a bit, though. I kind of think.
So you get to do two sides. You get to do sort of previously deaf Stew raging at the world, and then you get to do benign, I can hear everything Stew, tuned into Builders 20 miles away.
Yeah.
With a sense of love in your heart.
I know, yeah. Yeah.
And so you've just started. You were doing work in progress, weren't you?
Yeah, I'm still doing it now. Actually, I just had one last night, and I've tried to write a show. In the last 10 years, now I've written about 5 2-hour stand-up shows, and I've written 24 half-hour stand-up shows for telly. So I thought I'd try and write 2-hour-long shows that I'm doing sort of back-to-back as one show.
Yeah.
But it means each one's self-contained and they're slightly.
And they're totally different.
Well, they're not. I'm trying to have no cross-fertilisation between the halves. So just to kind of experiment to see how the hour-long shape feels. And also you can do one really running around and shouting one, and the other one sort of sitting down quietly with lots of really written sentences, you know, just to sort of have a tonal difference between them. But the written down sentences one isn't going as well at the moment as the running around shouting one. I think that's because I'm just too old to learn anything and too tired to write proper material now, and I've been pretending that it was a stylistic choice, but in fact it was a result of the incapacity to be able to think straight now.
And but you're not old enough to be able to run around. If the running around one's working for you, then there's still some pep.
Well, it's funnier, right? Because I mean, I thought maybe I should run around about 20-25 years ago, but I didn't do it. I kept it on the back burner.
You never moved.
Well, I knew it would be funnier to be running around when you were really fat and old, because people would have a sense of danger and tragedy about it. It's not funny to run around when you look like you can, is it?
No one laughs at the athlete.
No, either. No. And that's another thing. Do you remember there used to be a sketch show where Ben Miller and Alexander Armstrong used to be naked in it?
Yes.
I felt there was no honour in that because they were young,
handsome men.
There was nothing at stake in it. You know what I mean?
There was no genital
jeopardy. Yeah, it used to really annoy me. Whereas Sadovitz's nudity is high risk because there's very little.
And Malcolm Hardy's as well. Look at my junk.
Yeah.
My withered man junk.
Yeah.
And you'd cry with laughter.
I know, yeah. And actually, you see it with actresses routinely get praised for the bravery of nude scenes, but I think that it's compromising and it can be awkward and embarrassing, but the really brave ones. I mean, there was a film, Alamo Bay, I think it was Louis Brunel, and there were sort of older American art house actresses. Actor and actress Ed Harris, I think, at the time, doing a sort of nude scene where they just looked like ordinary people in bed, and that I felt was really high stuff. I sound like I'm working up telling you that I do the show nude, but
I'm hoping you don't. Just, if you don't now appear naked, I'm going to be furious. All this, he was clothed, you know, it's like a clothed Santa, and yet very busy, ran around.
Yeah.
No, there's got to be a world in which eventually you move towards an entirely naked set.
Maybe, yeah, I don't know. Well, not till the kids have left school. Because, I mean, I think about that a lot.
You'll never be on bullying because they can find you on social media.
I know, yeah, but I do make choices about some of the things I do now based on how it will affect the children.
Because when
my son was at his first school, I think some things happened to him as a result of perceptions of us as comedians or as the sort of work that we did.
And what would those perceptions be?
Either that you thought you were it and therefore the kids need to be brought down a peg or two, or they were behaving in a certain way because of us, or that we were, you know, not the sort of people you wanted your kids to be around because of sort of how people perceive shows. Certainly, I was offered a part in a film this year. Actually, I was offered a part in a film this year, and I've never been in a film, and I was surprised to be offered a part in a film. And then I read the scene, and what they wanted me to do was to be an executive in a meeting. And while I was giving the talk, another man came in behind and had sex with me from behind. And right. I just ignored it. And then carry on with the meeting? Yeah, then at the end pulled my trousers up when he'd gone. And I thought, well, I can't really do that. And one of the reasons I can't do it is if you've never done any films, but you've only done one, and that's the only thing you've done.
And your IMDb credit is man with trousers round ankles.
I know. But also I thought, I can't do that to the kids, actually. I can't have that as the only thing I've in film. I mean, it'd just be so... It's the kind of thing they'd just have here no end of, or it would be sort of held against you. So that was strange, you know.
Would you have done it had you not had kids?
Might have done, because it looks like it's going to be quite a good film, actually. I can't say what it is, but when it comes out and you see who's got the... It'd be Richard Herring ends up doing it. He's always the bloke. He's always the next down. And he'd do it, wouldn't he? He'd love it. But it's... And you'll see that scene, you'll go... You'll be able to think... I said, why did you ask me, actually? And he said him and the writer had been to see me at Leicester Square Theatre, and I've been doing a thing where if people's phones go off after I've told them to put them away,
yeah.
I go down, confiscate them, and I pull my trousers down and stick them sort of up my bum, basically, and leave them there for the rest of the show, but don't comment on it at all. And that tends to then prevent any further phone use in the room. Did you switch off before you...
Park them in.
No,
I leave it in
in case it rings, and then that'd be funny, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But they said they'd seen me do that, so they thought I'd be able to do this other thing.
I think that's it's quite a leap from somebody just casually putting a phone in their butt cheeks to
I know.
Being penetrated in the middle of a business meeting. I suppose.
What time does this go out? It doesn't go out any time, Grandad. It's a podcast.
Listen,
don't
on
you
Tyler.
Understand what it is?
What time is this? That's the thing. That is the sentence that enshrines how old we've become. Is this post Watershed? Is it?
When does it go out?
Is it? whenever you want. Whenever you want.
Really?
Father Christmas.
They don't understand now, the children. They go, can we watch, you know, Journey to the Centre of the Earth? Well, yeah. Oh, it's not on any. No, it's not on Amazon. And you can't watch it then, can you? You have to find it and. What? They can't understand not being able to get things straight away.
Yeah, if something isn't archived.
Yeah.
Then it's. But then who controls what's archived? Most of the stuff that we enjoyed growing up and watching, you can't.
No.
But thank God there's YouTube videos now on how to apply horror makeup.
Yeah, yeah. There's been a lot of the stand-ups of my generation have been dying the last couple of years, and it's interesting when you go to the wakes. It's interesting to come across people who are not documented in any way. You know, Jimmy Miller, Jim Macabre, who was, quite a big deal between about 87 and 92, set up one of the first New Material Nights, wrote a great line, if an infinite number of monkeys were given an infinite number of typewriters, eventually they would write, hey, hey, we're the monkeys. He died last year, or it was earlier this year, and there was just... At the wake, there was no film of him doing anything, which seems astounding now. All that had was Monica, who used to run a gig with him, had loads of flyers and photocopied, posters and that. So we sort of sat around passing these pre-digital papyrus artifacts around. But yeah, things that there's no film of, people can't believe. But there were loads of great acts in the 80s. Like, you probably remember that there's no real evidence of.
Well, listeners, the state of the world is pretty abysmal right now, but I think I've found the bit of light relief we all need. The Secret Diary of Boris Johnson, aged 13 and a quarter, is out now in all good bookshops. The book tells the story of how Alexander Boris de Pfeffel Johnson, a lazy, bumptious, entitled and overweening child, comes to decide that he should be Prime Minister. Along the way, we see him hone the techniques and persona that will one day allow him to hoodwink a nation. Author and comedy writer Lucian Young wields his satirical pen like a sword to expose and ridicule Boris's stupidity, abuses and vices. As this extract shows, young Boris was a man with many opinions. For the past 48 hours, I've been simply teeming with column ideas. Anytime a subject is raised, lo and behold, I have an opinion on it. Whether it's trades unions, X-rated films, or the Arab-Israeli conflict, your man Boris will take to his typewriter and hammer out the expected word count. It's so obvious to me now that this is my raison d'etre. I shall fill the world with my voice and my views. And if people don't like those views, I can always get new ones. The audiobook is read brilliantly by impressionist John Culshaw. I'll leave you with a gem of wisdom from 13-year-old Boris. 10 rules to live by. Number 6. A friend is just an enemy you haven't made yet. The Secret Diary of Boris Johnson, aged 13 and a quarter, is out now in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. I wanted to talk about something you said about 4 years ago that was very meaningful. Sorry about that.
I was probably drunk.
No, he was on stage. Right. It was scripted.
Oh, right.
You said, I'm paraphrasing badly, but you said the last great taboo is doing something sincerely and doing it well.
Mm.
That stayed with me.
Did it?
It did.
Yeah,
because
right.
Possibly because a lot of my life is about doing things sketchily and poorly. But it felt very true, and I wonder if it just sounded nice,
sometimes it's difficult to go back to old shows and think, because they were written in response to particular things at the time, and sometimes someone will go, oh, you said this, but actually it will be, things have changed since that was said. But I think what that came off the back of was I was having a lot of discussion, stroke arguments, stroke anxieties at the time about irony in comedy, and I actually think a few years down the line we might be sort of reaping the whirlwind of that now, if you know what I mean. I think that the assumption was that we lived in the assumption certainly amongst 20 and 30 somethings working in music or comedy or media or whatever was that political correctness was a good, was a done deal, you know, and we lived in a sort of, we were, the bad old days are behind us, and we lived in a sort of liberal democracy where the idea that you should be fair to everyone was enshrined, and therefore it was fun to kick against that, to take a position against it for comic effect. But as it happened, if that wasn't the case, that was a sort of veneer of what it looked like, and now it's as if that never happened, really. You know, we're heading to, well, the next thing the Conservatives weaponise will be a culture war about gender and sexuality and things like that, in the same way as they've done it about immigration and sort of cultural identity of that sort. So I think that line was about that sort of thing at that time, and I wondered what, and I thought, what if you tried to actually just say what you thought rather than trying to be arch or ironic, and that worked for that show. But then there are shows since where I've taken exaggerated positions that aren't mine for comic effect. But it was really that. I think it must have come off the back of other bits in that show.
Yeah, and it was towards the end as well, where it just made a nice sort of bridge to ending in a moment of sort of unguardedness, or supposed that. You might have just been playing us. You were capable of doing that.
Yeah,
you
bastards. Well, you know, it's again. I'll do shows. I'll do shows 250 times, you know, and when I first started to get some traction going for stand-up, in, say, 2004, that show was thought of as a hit, but I did it maybe 60 times, you know, and so it's you can't land. I didn't go to drama school, you know, and I can't land a convincingly emotional thing for real every night at the same point to order. So you do have to create little strategies to fake it now. But probably about the time I was doing that show, I could imagine I probably did put myself through whatever that was for real in my in my head every night. And now I have to use little sort of tricks to make things work sometimes.
Because you can feel it.
Yeah, and you can also... Some of the shows that were sort of traumatic. I did one in 2005 or six, which was about when all the censorship about when I was just off the back of working on Richard Thomas's Jerry Springer the Opera, I wrote quite an extreme show about censorship with a long sort of fantasy sequence in it about meeting Jesus, and I found it extremely draining. I felt really
that was hardcore. That
I mean, burned I know out that, yeah. by the end of that one. I didn't really like doing it, you know. There were some of the shows for a comedy vehicle, the telly show as well. There were two or three. There's one about the way that the deaths of comedians are talked about, and to get that to work every night at the point where I had to be upset, I would think about the deaths of the family members or whatever, so I could sort of get in the headspace, which actually was probably not a very good thing to have to do a lot, you know. And I don't really know how actors do things, not being one.
It's not a very healthy thing, is it, to dredge up pain?
Yeah.
I mean, to dredge up pain is a good thing, if you're going to expiate, if you're going to get rid of it, but just to for entertainment, that's what we do.
Better than doing manual labour, though.
No, it's much better than being... working down a mine.
I saw a man this morning pull up, and he got out of a lorry that he'd obviously been stuck in for ages, and when he got on the pavement and sort of went, poured loads of water over himself and then got back in it. And I thought, God, it's a long time since I've done any sort of work where I've felt so frustrated and stressed out by the actual physical side of it that I've just had to get out and throw loads of water over myself and I suddenly had a real feeling of luck. And then I walked through London to here and saw where Voltaire lived and blah, blah, and I thought, it's great to be alive. Then I got stuck out the front door here because there's no doorbell. And I was in a bad mood when I came in, but I'm all right now.
You've cheered right up. It's just worked out all right. Yeah, no, I'm reasonable. The lack of doorbell is trying.
I know. I shouldn't have to have that.
No, not at your age. No. Not at your age. Like, also,
the thing is, what you think is, it doesn't matter if there's a doorbell because people will go on their internet, on their phone, and but I don't know how to. I can't do that.
Well, this is the problem now, is that we've lost our motor skills because of the internet. Yeah. So instead of just trying to find a doorbell using our senses, what happens is I get a text from our shared agent who you've texted.
Yeah.
And then we come down and let you in.
And I've gone on Google, I've gone, where is the doorbell? And I've gone, Siri, where is the door? No, I don't know what. I haven't done that.
App now, because you've got an app where you can measure things. There must be an app which finds a doorbell. It can maybe photograph a door and locate the small aperture or knob where there's a.
What are you doing next after that? Not today, but generally, what's your next thing?
I'm trying to learn how to be a writer.
Well, you've written a book.
Yeah, I've written a book.
You are a writer then?
Well, I know it's a doing word, but I mean, I haven't done. Do you subscribe to that 10,000 hours nonsense? So that it's just, I mean, loosely I do, in the sense that
I don't
practice.
With stand up and some kinds of music, I think that the confidence and naivety and not understanding how difficult it is makes and thinking that you can do it without actually knowing that it's hard does mean that often people's first things are fantastic. Yeah. Right, and then the confidence is sort of sapped, and then maybe they do need the 10,000 hours. Because certainly with a lot of untutored sort of music or untutored sort of stand-up, the raw first thing is superb. Then as it's slightly finessed, it becomes kind of worse until they actually learn how to apply that sort of finesse to something.
You get co-opted, don't you? Yeah. Some people will like what you do, and then what do you do? Do you then just cater everything towards that group?
Yeah,
I mean, for you, how much of what you do is purely because you want to do it, and how much of it is because your following is so tribal, it's so committed? How much do you think what will they think?
Well, I don't give any thought to what the audience will want, and I try to do what I think will be a good thing. But I'm lucky in that, you know, now that I can do. I've got the financial leeway to do that. I could lose 50% of the people that come and see me, and I'd still be. I mean, the last tour I did, you know, 250,000 people with no advertising.
Bloody hell,
with no advertising, and it's off the radar because I don't do ATG theatres, so none of my tickets end up on those websites via GoGo and all those, and I don't do any advertising, and I do a week at the O2 numbers in London, but I do it at Leicester Square Theatre over three times the time. So it's sort of invisible. And I think actually Debbie, our shared agent, is starting to find that quite difficult because the way that your value is calculated now is by your Twitter followers and your media saturation.
Yeah.
Have you been on panel shows and did you play the Hammersmith Apollo or the O2? And I've managed to get a larger audience than that without doing any of those things, but actually, to a Netflix executive, you're sort of invisible because you don't fit those
algorithmic markers.
Marketing. Yeah. So, but actually, the thing about that is it means that you don't have to take them all with you because the economics stack up. You know. That's interesting because the Daily Telegraph or people online will try and hold you to account and go, if you say these sort of things, you will lose loads of your audience. As if that matters. Because to me, it's about being free, right? You know, you're in a luxury position where you can, you're free to do what you want. And so why would you write something and think people it would matter if people. I would do the same thing. My goal in 2004, when I realised that the economics of being with a big agency like Avalon, which I was with then, weren't going to work, was could I do 5,000 people a year and get £10 from each of them? And then that would be... If I could do that and not have to change what I did, it would be fine. And the weird thing is, once I started doing that, it kind of snowballed.
But it's the fact that you don't care and that you double down that gives. That's why people come, because there's a sort of sense of, I'm going to do what pleases me and I'm going to enjoy it. And if you don't, but also to say, since the hearing loss, you're also they love being insulted. They want you to punish them.
Yeah, but I also think they come. I also think people come back, and this is a simple sort of. you know, this just sounds like someone running a shop. You know, every 18 months or so, there's a new product. It's about 2 hours long, so they basically get twice as long as they do off another stand-up. At half the price, because I do it in places that have low overheads, and I don't have to spend money on advertising, or I haven't got a massive thing of my name written along the back of the thing, or a horse or something on stage.
Massive,
you know?
Set.
I want to sometimes have really massive sets, that they have to be one person to be able to put them together. Yeah. You know? And so it's just sort of like that. I suppose I say what I want, but the actual product of the thing is dependable year after year. You know, and it's I write it, and it's sort of.
You also sell your own merch. That's what I love about you. At the end of the gig, you'll set up a mini Stewley shop.
Yeah, that's interesting doing the new shop because a lot of people franchise it out to these companies, you know. But when I tour around with a guy called James Hengley, who is one of the reasons that I still find it able to do it, because he's a very easy person to be around with. And he does the tech and the merch with me, you know, and he does the driving. And we basically spend quite a lot of time talking about stocking up the shop and where should we put the shop and stuff. So it takes your mind off the actual stress of doing the show, because you think you're running a kind of touring
mobile pop-up shop.
Bookshop, yeah. And you know, that's one of the reasons I don't do the ATG theatres, because they want 25% plus VAT for the merchandise. It means you end up having to charge more for your books and things than they would cost in the shops, just to get... cover the cost of what it cost you to buy them. It's ludicrous. So I really like the shop aspect. And this sounds like showbiz name dropping, but only to a small amount of people. Thurston Moore, late of Sonic Youth, 80s hardcore experimental avant rock pioneers, came to see us at Leicester Square Theatre. And he was really impressed by us running the shop. He said it was a real punk rock thing to do. And he gave us loads of tips about how they used to do there. And they used to have a thing that said merch and destroy over their over their thing, and how you can crunch things down to get them on the van to tour them. And he seemed it was really great to have. There were so many questions I'd like to have asked him about obscure guitar tunings and things like that. But really, it was just about the practicalities of. But yeah, I love running the own merch stand, and to me, it's an extra joke, because the show might finish with you going, "And I hate all of you, and don't ever come to this again." Sort yourselves out and all whatever.
Smash capitalism. Yeah, and then
it goes to, thank you, blackout. In the blackout, I can jump off the stage.
So you actually run.
Off the front of the stage and I run through the audience.
To make money from merchandise.
And then I get out of the back and I get to the thing. And as they're coming out, I'm going, hello, would you like an autumn ring? Like, really nice thing.
I've got a bundle of DVDs here that I think for a bargain price of 20 quid.
Yeah, but it's really funny to go... It undercuts the idea of the integrity of the performance. That
that's what I love. It's total punk. It's basically saying, I'm going to spend 2 hours, you know, cajoling, berating, attacking, looking at the capitalist superstructure in which we languish and curse you all for partaking in it. And then I'm going to jump off a stage, some of which quite high.
Are they? I've done my knees in, actually. And
I'm too self-serving heavy to desperation
I'm too
to make
heavy
money.
Well, it's also actually it's a really good way of dealing with a particular thing, which I saw... Something on telly. I don't know why it was on. It was the end of a Russell Brand gig, and the audience, people were waiting for him, and he sort of came down this massive staircase in a theatre, sort of red carpet, and was going, and I was thinking, oh, come on, you know. And because the sort of music I like, afterwards, the people are just selling their CDs off the stage, and you talked about it, and that's really what makes the tour viable. And then you can ask your question. You can say, why is the third track on this, you know, played backwards at the end or whatever? So when the people queue up at the end, it's sort of, it's that naff thing of meet the minor celebrity, but everyone is spared the embarrassment of it, because it's changed into this, transaction. They don't even have to buy anything, but it's sort of formalised, and also it doesn't get bogged down because there are other people coming along, so the interactions are sort of... Everyone gets an interaction, but it doesn't become awkward for anyone. So it's like a way of, and I am grateful for the people that are coming. I mean, I really am. That's what annoyed me when the Telegraph did a real stitch up review once, where, you know, the whole angle of the show was that I'd saying I didn't want people to come and they weren't good enough to come and they didn't understand it and everything. Of course, everyone in there is really laughing at that, you know. And then the Telegraph ran this review saying, if he understood anything about ordinary people's working lives, he would show them some respect and not. You show them the respect by doing the 2-hour show for 23 quid, like half the price of what anyone else. You know, that's.
And meeting them afterwards.
And that, and so it really annoyed me because I am really grateful for people coming. Because, like you say, they find it without prompting, and they've sat through some pretty hard and misguided things over the years that didn't really work. And they come back, and I really like the people as well. And I like to see them because I like to know that they're. You know, again, when you get attacked in the Telegraph, the idea is that you're playing to this middle class liberal elite audience. Now, there's a lot of them, but there's a spread of all times, and I like it when you see a family where, because grandparents come because they think I'm like Dave Allen, you know, and the kids, little teenagers, will come because they don't have this kind of comedy now, so it's sort of exciting to them because it's not like someone being their friend in a t-shirt, and so. You know, I like it when there's all. I like seeing who they are, and I like seeing them growing up over the years. The audience members.
They do follow you. I mean, I've seen some of the same faces at the gigs I've been to. But also, I mean, we'll talk about criticism in a minute. Yeah. But it seems to me that what you're doing is asking of an audience, what do you want your role to be in all this?
Well, it is, and on a good night, the audience are they're like a partner in a double act, which obviously I was in for one period.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel.
You know, another thing some of the critics don't get is sometimes the audience, right, there'll be a deliberately rubbish joke that doesn't work, and they sort of laugh at it to make fun of it, right? They kind of play the role of a certain kind of audience. Not all of them, some of them. Sometimes they kind of get in a groove where they know that they're supposed to pity you. So they do. They don't actually pity you. They know that
they know it's a construct.
They know it's a construct and that I am disproportionately wealthy given my talent, you know, as a result of the luck I've had in. They don't pity me, but the thing wouldn't work if they didn't at least pretend to. So you're inviting them to sort of perform as well, and I think and they rise to the challenge, and I think a load of people, you know, sometimes a load of people are really great, and they can sort of they also somewhere like Glasgow, Liverpool, sometimes some of the places that people think oh they're tough there, they are, but they don't want to kill you, no. They want to toy with you like a cat and keep you alive. They want to keep you alive to see what happens. And once you understand that, they don't want you to fail, but they want you to work hard. Right?
They have higher expectations.
They have higher expectations. And I like that about them. Yeah. We're living in a period where a lot of the times when you see large crowds of people and you hear the things they're chanting, you feel a sense of despair. But the large groups of people in rooms sometimes for things, they're nice audiences you get.
And because they are being part of your audience, you are collectively taking on the responsibility of being your sparring partner.
Yeah, yeah.
And even though we haven't got words and that's not our role. The atmosphere, and as you say, we get to be cretins and you get to be bombastic.
Yeah.
And it works. And in many ways, as you've said, it replicates in simple form what you were doing in your double act.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of the things that is there, you know, from the double act is sometimes, you know, you find your... I don't do the other voice, but it's sort of implicit, as if there's an argument with an imaginary person, you know, or because I mean, really, we can dress a lot of comedy up as writing and the choice of words and whatever, but ultimately it's about a rhythmical thing that people find pleasing, and that's got there's counterpoints in it, and one melody is sort of doing this and the other one's undercutting it, and so it's where those sounds and rhythms fall.
If you think about, I always think about music starts. If you imagine it as like it always starts with nothing. That is that's the canvas.
Yeah,
and so that's us as an audience.
It's nothing. You did the conducting thing, didn't you?
I love music. Yeah. I think you're right, because so much of writing and performance is about juxtaposing the lyrical with the percussive, yeah. and yeah. you know, a lot of what I love about your you. When I think about what you do, I think of minimalism, and I think of the phrasing, and it gets repeated.
Well, that's because I've ripped that off.
but no one did it in comedy. People did it in music, but no yeah. one did the. Yeah. How will you feel if I say the same thing again and again and
yeah.
again, and it changes?
Can be different, yeah.
And every time it's different.
Yeah, it's different because of how it's responded to as well.
And before it was just reincorporation. It would be the idea: there's someone tell a joke, and then 20 minutes later, there'd be a callback.
Yeah.
But you're almost doing callbacks in the moment.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things said there, Ron. So I heard Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead on the radio being interviewed the other day. It was a brilliant interview. He talked about textures and dynamics of music. He talked about the difference between the silence in a room and then as the orchestra starts, that little moment. And it was a really great description of moving from expectation to the excitement of it. Really great. The other thing I was thinking about was, my wife's gone off to see, is going to see a musical, a famous musical for some reason. I remember when we worked on Jerry Springer, the opera, it was really difficult because when it moved up from a fringe show to a West End show, it wasn't enough to just have the music. The music had to be arranged, right? That meant it had to have layers of string accompaniment or whatever. And that was really difficult because the music that Richard Thomas had written worked often in dramatic opposition to the words. So there was a comic tension between either the violence of the words and the romanticism of the music, or the romanticism of the words and the violence of the music. Once you bring an arranger has to decide whether the arrangement is going to support the music or the lyrics, because it can't emotionally do both, because they were pulling in different directions. And I think the arrangements compromised it in a way that it meant it was never as good again, because it was because the audience were directed to emotionally respond to it in a certain way.
Yeah.
And what I like is there's always sort of two things in opposition, you know, two things in opposition. And you try and do that in the stand-up to perform sensible, serious things as if they were stupid, or stupid things as if they were serious. And pretty much everything seems to come down to that. It's like, otherwise it's just all too one note, just rolling forwards.
It's rage and futility, isn't it? It's like,
yeah,
such strength, and then underneath it, this incredible, brittle vulnerability of we're all fucked.
Yeah.
We're all fucked.
Yeah, well.
I mean, I know you love music, but I do think so much of the success of what you've done, not just because you're incredibly strong at performing, but it's because the way you write and the way things sound, and sometimes it's just very hypnotic. So I didn't get this
boring voice, that's what it is as well.
The Solly Hull vowel.
Yeah, that's what Robbie Williams came once. I didn't know he was in, but he left at half time, and as he was going, the usher said to him, oh, you know, and he went, he should do hypnosis tapes, that bloke. He said, I thought it was really funny.
Grass & Co. is a premium range of products that blend the highest quality 100% natural CBD with therapeutic botanical ingredients. The organic CBD and botanical formulations have been specially created to bring balance to your body and mind with the most delicious, smooth flavours. The new Grass & Co. Calm CBD range includes balancing botanicals Evening Primrose, Ashwagandha, Chamomile, Marula and Mint to help relax your body and calm your mind. Now, many people who've already tried CBD oils think that the challenging taste is just something you have to put up with to enjoy the benefits. But the guys at Grass & Co. disagree. They've blended their CBD with organic botanical ingredients, including ginger, turmeric, orange and mint, for the most delicious smooth flavours. If you're new to CBD, the best-selling 500mg Calm CBD oil is a great starting point. As with all supplements, CBD will affect everyone differently. So start low and steadily build your dosage every day so you find the balance that works with your body. The Grass & Co. Calm range brings peace and tranquility to your day with CBD consumable oils, nourishing body oils and peaceful pillow sprays. Comforting aromatherapy scents have been specially blended to quieten your mind and soothe your body. The Grass & Co. complete range delivers exactly what you need when you need it, whether that be taking the CBD oil first thing in the morning to prepare for a busy day at work, or at the end of the day, the aromatherapy scents can help reduce sleep anxiety and establish the habit of falling asleep. Simply spritz the Calm pillow spray generously onto your pillow and bed linen. Inhale the pure aromatherapy scent slowly and deeply to welcome a deep, restful sleep.
And now, listeners to this podcast can get 20% off the full range. Just head over to www.grassandco.com/hour. Grass & Co are the CBD wellness experts and are committed to delivering the best product range to their customers. Quality and integrity drive their approach to everything they make and do. They openly share the certificates of analysis with customers on website product pages. With no trace of THC, Grass & Co's CBD oils are totally legal to buy and consume within the UK and most EU countries. I've tried them and they're great. So get 20% off the full Grass & Co range by going to www.grassandco.com/hour and entering hour at checkout. Grass & Co. Life enhanced by nature.
There's so much of what you do that's about absorbing criticism, absorbing... and I wonder how much of that is just externalising what's inside. I mean, you will publish... You know, your latest book, March the Lemmings, it's all about you've included the under-the-line stuff that you've got from the columns.
Yeah.
And there's a glee.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that part of absorbing the criticism is that when obviously, with stand-up, if you're doing it under your own name, you are yourself. You're not a pub landlord or an urban warrior or whatever you are yourself, but you have to, you know, exaggerate bits of yourself. And I think that lots of different people helped me to work out who the stand-up was. When I first lived in London, 89-90, I'd come in from my temp job complaining about things, and the people who I lived with at the time, principally Richard Herring, who I ended up doing the double act with, would say, that just sounds like material. Your actual opinion of your description of your day, you've had such an extreme unself-aware response to that. It sounds like they said, kind of people have helped you realise what a theatre person would say is, what's your clown, you know?
Yeah.
And then subsequently, when the internet was invented, I didn't really realise what was going on the internet for about 10 years. And then when I think the first series of Comedy Vehicle was on, I realised there were all these forums of people.
Mm.
This is about 2007, 2008, yeah, commenting on it, and I started looking at them, and loads of the things they hated about it were sort of what I was trying to do. You know, they'd go, it's this smug, detached person trying to build up, make everyone think they're clever and they're not. And I thought, well, yeah, that's sort of what he is, right? And so I looked at all those criticisms. Between the first and second series of Comedy Vehicle, the criticisms really strengthened it, because I became more like the things that people didn't like.
But it's interesting you said that's what he is. And that's,
yeah, I know.
You've used
Yeah, I know, I do it all the time. Yeah.
But can you work out what... I mean, I'm not asking you for percentages, but yeah. I mean, presumably it's just... It sometimes it's very you and sometimes it's a posture, I guess.
Yeah, it is. I mean, so and also sometimes I'm inside my head and he's going on and I'm sort of thinking, what if he said this now? It'd be absolutely awful. And then he'll say it and I'll go, oh, now I've got to try and get out of that. And he's really... he's put me in a really difficult position. So it's sort of like you can force... You know, and I do... again, it's like two things in a... You know,
yeah.
Look, I think anyone who writes anything's got to be able to split their brain in some way like that, you know, to sort of, you have the thing that's doing it and the thing that's commenting on it.
But not many people are brave enough to go, everyone can think of the worst thing in the world, but not many people will let it escape their mouth.
Well, that's one of the things that's in those American script writing handbooks, isn't it? You know, put your character in the most incredible jeopardy and then try and work back from it. But yeah, it's sort of what position can you put yourself in, you know? And also in every show I try and do something that I'm not very good at, whether it's trying to sing a song or do something.
I love that though. That's the vulnerability bit underneath the bluster. But maybe he says something awful and Stu Lee has to work out how he feels about that.
Yeah, I know. Although again, you must have that. I mean, you have to go into, for a bake-off or something, you have to step up into a sort of... what's interesting about that is the pair of you are doing a TV presenter job, but there's still you're still the double act in it.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's two things happening there, aren't there? You have to deliver televisual information, and yet at the same time, there's a suggestion that the two people that have been given this job have some historic bickering relationship, which isn't what happens with people who are presenting Antiques Roadshow or something, is it?
Absolutely.
Which is clearly what people again, when they tried to, I expect you've signed a non-disclosure agreement.
No, I can say anything.
When they tried to, didn't people typically have telling people understand that there was some other thing going on there which was bigger than the sum of its parts? You know, so when you move it over, you can't just recreate that relationship with some other people because it's an organic thing. It's not going to be the same. You know?
I suspect what our counterpoint was is that we were in together. We feel like subversive children. We feel the faces may have withered, but inside there's just this caprice.
Okay, you
and
get
naughtiness.
This. You can't believe you've been allowed to do that sort of thing. So, what would they do? They'd have fun with it, wouldn't they?
And then suddenly you're in this. It didn't start that way, but suddenly you become this culture, part of this culturally safe, enshrined thing. And yet inside you're delinquent children watching people watching ovens. So I get it. Yeah, you can have... And they would record hours of me deconstructing it and just deconstructing a time check. I'd do a 20-minute time check, which would be about... the pointlessness of everything, and they would never use it. But that's fine, as long as I got to say it.
I did realise there was a limitation to with me to in between all the series of Comedy Vehicle, there was always reluctance about recommissioning it.
Yeah.
However many BAFTAs it won or British Comedy was, I could never quite get anyone to in between the first, maybe the second and the third series. It was suggested that. I would, you know, and it was getting reasonable figures as well. It was suggested that it would be easier to recommission it if I became a sort of BBC Two personality and went on lots of things.
Are you telling me they asked you to do Celebrity Bake Off?
No, but they did ask me to host a culture show, right? And I thought, look, that doesn't help me, does it? Because I can't host a culture show and be nice about to think about people and things and then do that show. So it doesn't make sense. It's too... different, you know. So I went, look, I'm not going to, it actually will compromise that thing to go and do those things. It just, the nature of the Comedy Vehicle, it just wouldn't work to also be hosting the culture show. And also, because I do like lots of culture, I could only really have done things that I actually was interested in or liked. I wouldn't be able to. So I wrote a routine about how annoyed I was that the BBC had asked me to host the culture show. And that
did
I
that
was
help
culture,
the recommissioning process?
And that I was better than the culture show because I directed an opera and the culture show every week should just be me interviewing me about things that I'd done. And that Andrew, along with hating Andrew Graham Dixon and him going around art galleries and things and then saying he was the crumpet man's, that Joan Bakewell had been the thinking man's crumpet and he was the crumpet man's thinker and stuff. I basically deliberately burned all the bridges with it. And I found out some people that worked on the culture show were very upset about it because, I mean, I did quite like the culture show and it was fighting a losing battle against the people feeling art and culture is irrelevant anyway. But I thought, I've got to do this because he wouldn't do that, right? And he would be really angry about the idea that he should go and host the culture show in order to get his own thing on. So,
but do you get annoyed that he is crushing, I mean, not necessarily the culture show, but he crushes opportunity?
He does, yeah. But then, you know, we'll do all right. I mean, I don't. That's why he does crush opportunity. Yeah, he's done something in the new show that means it'll be very difficult for Netflix to buy it. And Debbie said, "Well, if you just
Debbie's already said that, so we share an agent." And Debbie, who is magnificent, I asked after you yesterday, and she said she said exactly that. It's going to be very difficult to sell him on.
But then,
because he's made that happen.
Yeah, but then he would, wouldn't he? Because he.
What does he want from you?
I don't know.
What does he want you to just live in a ditch, ranting in a ditch?
But
cursing people who walk past.
This is the thing, isn't it? You're like, okay. But you get, I know that loads of people come. I know it's loads of people's favourite thing. And I know that people that really know about stand-up will go, oh, this person's one of the better people, you know. And then you get this really odd blip where you might get something like The Times saying, you know, The Times, I'm the world's greatest living stand-up. You know, meanwhile, your nephew has doesn't really believe you even do it. You know, it's sort of, you can't really. My nephew said to me, so you go on like TV and stuff? And I went, yeah, in fact, I've produced more hours of stand-up for television than any other living comedian, and it was more critically acclaimed than the similar work of anyone else. And I could just see him sort of looking at me, just thinking, well, I'd have seen it, wouldn't I? You know, like, I thought it'd be funny to just say that really bluntly to a 13-year-old and see what happened. And you know, just, you can just see it's just can't be processed. So on the one hand, you're thinking, well, I do all this stuff, so I should be able to get money to film things or whatever. But then on the other hand, it's my choice not to join in and to remain free. And I still have a really good life. So I don't really, you can't really complain, you know, you can't really complain. And I can move around largely without anyone bothering me. I remember we met in Edinburgh a few years ago, and you know, we were in a sort of tent somewhere in a square having a coffee, and yeah. my stepfather and his partner were just sort of the couldn't really believe that I would know you, you know, because you're on that level of fame. It must be quite crazy. Difficult.
I don't think about it, right, though. Yeah. I can't inhabit. I don't have a her. I guess I am just. Yeah. I'm more integrated in that way, and I sort of think. People are usually nice, and that's great. And I think if I mean, it's waned now anyway. It's also temporary, all that silly stuff.
Yeah.
But God, I'm glad I didn't peg my sense of self worth onto it, because the celebrity index only goes one way, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. In the end, yeah. Well, that's like all political lives end in failure or death, don't they? Yeah. It's the same with very few people get to leave. The world of celebrity being as popular as they
as faced and I guess it's for me it's about because I didn't have a her going don't do that often said yes to things that possibly in one reflection were less that. So you've always, however painful it's been for you and however awkward it is to say this, I suppose you're one of, for me, those people that you aspire to be because there's that rigidity of purpose. But maybe it's not like, maybe it's it's never been that discipline for you.
I can't really cope with lots of other things, you know. I mean, I can't really work a lot with other people. I just get sort of worn out with it, even when they're really nice.
By the compromise?
I can't. And I don't like the amount of time it takes to finish. I like the fact with stand-up you can do it on your own terms and get it done and then do something else and, you know. I can't learn lines. I can't, you know.
The hallmark of a comic is there's no transferable skills, really.
No transferable skills. That is something that's changed, I think. I think that when we started, a lot of the people doing it, there probably wasn't, they were sort of, it felt like a calling, you know, because there wasn't, no one knew that you could do stadiums or become.
There was no live at the Apollo.
It was just. I mean, my ambition when I started, and it was I thought it'd be great to be able to do a 30-day tour at some point of 120-seater art centres. You know, that was really being a folk singer, wasn't it? And then telly. I mean, telly wasn't like it is now. It was, you know.
But also, it's changed so much so that Edinburgh now, if you go to listen to an hour, and some may be great, by the way, I don't mean this to denigrate anyone's work, but it'll be mining pain and tragedy thematically for 60 minutes, and then you're out and onto the next one. Yeah. And
there were 10 stand-up shows when I first went to the Edinburgh Fringe in 87. There'll be 400 now, you know, 500, and they've become formulae, and I kind of think it's true. This is true of so many things in modern culture. You've described a trend in stand-up, which is for the spill your guts personal show. Mm. And there was a moment where that looked like it was going to be a dominant trend, but then what happens now is lots of things carry on simultaneously. For years, the Telegraph, which seems to come up a lot, was trying to say that there was a right-wing comedy movement, and there never was. There'd be maybe two people.
Yeah.
But now there is. But there's a really extreme left-wing one, and there's a spill your guts one, and there's a surreal one, and they're all happening simultaneously because there's enough ways for people to find out about, and that means nothing happens at the expense of another one. And a lot of the American stand-up seems to be furious about Hannah Gadsby doing well in America because they, I think partly because it's raised their game a bit and it's made them think they should try and write hours that make some sort of sense and not be so shit. But also the way they attack it is, are we all supposed to cry and talk about being assaulted now? No, you can do what you want, right? That's a thing. That's a way of doing it. But there's other ways of doing it as well. And they all happen.
I think they're furious that they, you know, they want her pain without having to go through it. They want to have the anecdote of the pain without experiencing the pain. And it's like the reason that, I mean, that show sort of, you know, was explosive because it, again, it's what you do, which is saying, why don't you look at yourself for a second? You've just laughed. You've participated in the relief of tension. Now let me tell you what really happened and see how you sit with that. That was just a very interesting exercise in what is, in what's demanded of a renter crowd, which is what you're part of.
Yeah.
But it does seem like the people that rail against her, it's like, okay, do you want to rewind and go through what she went through? Then your hour is just a
flight. It's not stopping you doing your thing anyway.
Everyone has pain. You know, it's like... I remember the late Jeremy Hardy going on stage in Cornwall and goes, I bring news, everyone has light. It's not just, and that made me laugh. It's the same, everyone has pain. It's just, some people don't want to access it. And I think certain rank and file comics don't want to go there because they're just more comfortable with.
I often think this a lot. I mean, when Jimmy Carr got done for that tax avoidance, and I thought, right, he's either finished now or he writes a brilliant show about it. You know, which seems to be a way out for some of the people in the States being accused of sexual impropriety. There seems to be a suggestion that if they manage to address this in some way, almost like a medieval public flagellation, then that the show will be the redemption. I thought it would have been the making of him as a comic, but it never occurred to him. I talked to him, he went, no, I don't think people want to know about that. You know, I thought, that'd be amazing to see Jimmy Carr talk about something. And in a way, what a gift. We all sort of wish, in a way, something would happen to us that would be that interesting. Like when I was being mugged, I was sort of thinking, it's interesting. And when Boyle's got in trouble for tasteless jokes, not so much anymore because he's been sort of reimagined as a sort of liberal satirist, but when he used to get in trouble for tasteless jokes, I think it was really interesting that those jokes were probably written by a team of writers anyway, which he was required to sort of front out. And I thought, what an interesting show that would be to take the joke you'd got vilified for the tabloids about, talk about the process by which it was constructed, and then write. You know, I thought, I kind of think with a lot of the mainstream acts, there's a brilliant, brilliant show staring them in the face, but it would mean they would have to sort of step back a bit from the thing there.
Well, the sort of horrific mechanism of achieving authenticity in comedy, which is, you say you have, you know, comics who have a team of writers fabricating anecdotes about their nan.
And that's
as you say. I mean, there's a multiverse. There's lots of different types of comedy going on simultaneously.
That's an interesting thing. That's happened quickly. Is that, again, when we started, and you really funny sound how quickly you sound like old club comedy.
When did we get so gnarly?
When we started, there was a sort of thing. One of that people wrote their own stuff. It was a sort of defining thing of the alternative comedy from the 80s. Was that you wrote this stuff? And now, then there was a sort of hush-hush period about 10 years ago where lots of the big names were using teams of writers, but they were given odd job titles to sort of disguise it.
Oh,
and now people just go, oh, yeah, I'm a writer for so-and-so. And I go, someone's telling me they're a writer for so-and-so the other night. I knew the other writers were. And I went, oh, you shouldn't really be telling me this because I don't want to know that, because to me it's an embarrassing thing. But and then I thought, oh, yeah, they don't mind now anymore. It's not even a thing. You know, it's sort of out there.
It's a strange thing, isn't it, that you get to that stage where you can be so transparent about the fact that personal experiences have been fabricated by paid staff.
But I changed them. I changed them enough that the people involved won't recognise themselves, because I hate anyone to be upset on a personal level, you know. The brother-in-law character in the last stand-up show is a composite of about six or seven different people's things that they've said so that nobody could really feel aggrieved by it. And I always change the ages and gender and names of my children in every time they're mentioned in the book that I'm probably here supposed to be promoting, March of the Lemmings. They're mentioned about a dozen times. And in each story about them, they've got different names, ages and genders. They're changed every time because I don't want to... Yeah. You know, I don't want to have that part of it, really. I don't want to really... I think you've got to hold your life back.
And yeah, it's interesting because you're so protective of, and you provide composites of family members and loved ones, but you will, in every show, there will be an explicit sort of well-known target that will just be...
Although, again, I think... Well, that goes back to the old thing of, are you punching up or down, doesn't it? You know, and some of the people that... I mean, some of the people... James Corden was very upset, apparently, about something I did about him that I just thought was... I knew he was a fan of me, which is partly why I did it. Sort of, I thought he'd like it, to have me being annoyed with him and... was I spitting on him? I can't remember. There was something... I thought he'd think it was funny, really. I would. I mean, I only know it because I really like The Fall.
Yeah.
And then he's dead now, Marky Smith. But there is... People were always sending me tapes and he'd be changing lyrics to say I was a stupid cunt and things like that. And it was like really like sort of... If I ever end up like Stuart Lee, cut off my head with a garden tool and he'd sort of... People go, oh, have you seen he said this? And he probably didn't really like me because I'm a, you know, middle-class twat. But I think it was also an element of it just to be noticed by them is quite... I quite liked it, really.
Yeah.
But when I was in the audience at gigs and I was being berated, attacked on stage, and I remember I was with Munnery once watching about 97, and he seemed to be changing loads of lyrics into complaining about me and saying how terrible I was.
This is unbelievable.
And I sort of imagined it, and Munnery turns to me, I think so, yeah, it's really weird.
That's so weird. So your sort of hero is referencing you in a really... Maybe that's why you do it now. You just go, it's fair game.
I thought it was funny.
Stu, what an honour. Thanks, mate.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Stuart's new book, March of the Lemmings, is out now at all good bookshops and online, and you can catch him on another one of his extensive UK tours. Details can be found at stuartlee.co.uk.
Yes, it's true.
All the music in this episode was provided by Waiting for Smith, and if you want to check out more Waiting for Smith, then go to Spotify. As always, you can post reviews at Apple Podcasts, you can post abuse to my Twitter feed at Sue Perkins. All are welcome. I'll be heading find my peace where the desert